create a new business model. I am my own test market. I am far more intuitive than analytical. If I sense an opportunity to reframe something I'm passionately interested in, I give it my absolute best shot. The commitment to add something fresh to an existing dialogue informs every decision my colleagues and I make, from the locations we select, to our staff uniforms, to virtually every dish we serve. Whether the topic is poached striped bass, tuna tartare, a BLT, or a cup of hot chocolate, I challenge my chefs to tell me exactly what they're planning to do differently from or better than the next guy. Years ago, for instance, we knew that we needed to offer steak on the menu at Union Square Cafe in a city that already claims some of the world's greatest steakhouses. I also knew that there was no way we could outdo Sparks, The Palm, Peter Luger, Smith & Malensky, or any of the other temples of beef. So we came up with the idea of our smoked steak, a great piece of meat cold-smoked, grilled, and then served with world-class mashed potatoes and topped with fried leeks. Sirloin steak could have been a kind of every-restaurant-needs-a-steak throwaway on our menu. Instead, our smoked steak became a reason people return over and over again to Union Square Cafe. Still, in reframing something that people are familiar with, the outcome must be excellent and must never seem contrived. Despite the continued success of Union Square Cafe, for almost 9 years I was firmly against opening a second restaurant. Owing in large part to my experience of my father's tumultuous career and his two bankruptcies, I always thought of expansion as dancing on the edge of failure. It wasn't until after my father died that I began to give myself the freedom to expand my business. It was almost as if my fear of repeating his defeats was softened by the fact that he wouldn't be around to see the outcome. Another factor was that for years I had protected myself from the perils of growth by establishing three prerequisites that I knew would be almost impossible to meet. First, any new restaurant would have to be as excellent within its niche as Union Square Cafe. In my mind, the success of Union Square Cafe had been a fluke, and I was fairly certain I'd never have a hit like that again. Second, the opening of the new restaurant could in no way compromise or diminish the excellence of Union Square Cafe. Restaurant sequels can diminish the original, perhaps because the management's focus and capacity may be spread too thin. Third, I would open another restaurant only when I was sure that I would also achieve more time for myself and Audrey. That seemed unlikely, as I was already working up to 14 hours a day. At this point in our lives, Audrey and I were married, but still without kids. Audrey had successfully transitioned from a career as a stage actress to become a leading member of the publishing and sales team at Gourmet Magazine. Since we had met in the restaurant business, neither of us had had to adjust our expectations about what demands my career would place on us as a couple. But with each year of Union Square Cafe's progress as a prominent restaurant, I found myself working harder and longer to exceed increasingly ratcheted expectations, the public's and my own. We were intent on having kids, all the more so because each of us had now lost a parent. I did a lot of soul-searching, asking myself whether taking on more business and more stress would be wise for me or for my marriage, or even for my business. To her credit, Audrey left the decision to me. In the early 1990s, I was doing a lot of thinking about how much I enjoyed luxury dining. I was inspired by Michelin-starred restaurants in France and Italy, especially the two-star restaurants, which seemed able to combine refinement with genuine warmth. I was also increasingly impressed by the improved quality of cooking here in the United States. I loved the food and wine served at these great restaurants, but I was less moved by their customary pomp and circumstance. So I was presented with a dilemma in 1992 when the restaurant Mondrian closed. Mondrian had received a 3-star rating from the New York Times, and I knew and greatly admired its chef, Tom Colicchio. Now, Tom asked me if I would be interested in starting a new restaurant with him. I was not thinking about opening a new restaurant, but how could I say no to a collaboration with such a gifted, passionate chef? I knew he was the right choice, and with Audrey's encouragement, I began to plan a new restaurant with him. We agreed that we wanted to combine the elements of luxury dining that we most loved, but to present them within a new framework. I had in mind the lovely restaurants I had enjoyed in the French and Italian countryside, as well as the taverns that Audrey and I had frequented in and around Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Audrey grew up there, and in New England. She and I had become addicted to the hunt for early American antiques. While we were childless, our routine on many weekends was to travel in search of shops and auctions in Maine, Vermont, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, find a historic tavern for dinner in the evening, and stay overnight at a bed and breakfast. Though the food in the old taverns rarely rose above, say, mixed salad with raspberry vinaigrette, duck with cherry sauce, and chocolate mousse, I always found the folk-style atmosphere appealing. Exploring the idea of the tavern and imagining how to apply it in a fresh way was becoming a fixation. Tom and I began by asking, whoever wrote the rule that the only way to enjoy luxurious fine dining is in the environment of a stuffy restaurant with tuxedo-clad waiters and a stiff, hushed atmosphere? And whoever wrote the rule that a rustic tavern couldn't also be a setting for truly outstanding modern food? Union Square Cafe had become known as an excellent version of a neighborhood restaurant, so it occurred to me that Gramercy Tavern might succeed as a neighborhood version of an elegant restaurant. In one case, the goal was to take some element of dining that was already accessible and make it even better. In the other, it was to take an element of excellent dining that was rarefied and make it more accessible. Some people expect a stuffy ambience at Gramercy Tavern, but when they walk in, they find an animated community hall with excellent food and drink. This setting immediately puts guests at ease and makes it somewhat easier for the restaurant to exceed expectations. We worked with Peter Bentel and his remarkably talented and focused family of architects, whom I had met serendipitously through the contractor who completed Audrey's in my apartment. The Bentels were famous for designing churches and libraries, but this would be their very first restaurant. We began with a fantasy that what we were designing had always been the tavern for the Gramercy Park community, and that we had continued to update it over the past century. Now, as Gramercy Tavern, it would continue to play its earlier role as the community's best place to meet, eat, and drink. As we pounded the pavement looking for a site, my one requirement was to be as close as possible to Union Square Cafe and the Green Market. The name Gramercy Tavern was first suggested to me by the writer and television producer Peter Kaminsky, a longtime bar lunch regular at Union Square Cafe, who was writing an article for The New Yorker about the process of opening our restaurant. At the last moment, and after months of work, his story was canned by Tina Brown, who was then the magazine's editor. But 2 weeks before our opening, Peter sold his story to New York Magazine. Its editor, Kurt Anderson, made Gramercy Tavern his cover story on our opening day. Tom and I each had something to prove at Gramercy Tavern. Tom's cooking at Mondrian had received wide acclaim, including the 3 stars from the New York Times, and he was determined to show the world that Mondrian's failure to survive was caused by the bad economy of the early 1990s, rather than by a flawed menu or mismanagement. And I needed desperately to prove to myself that Union Square Cafe had not been a one-hit fluke. There had been many changes in New York in the 9 years since I'd opened Union Square Cafe. President Clinton's new economy had taken off, crime rates were beginning to recede, and the category of casual, excellent restaurants like Union Square Cafe was becoming saturated. Business at Gramercy Tavern was intense from the start. In fact, there was a lively media buzz about the restaurant, and we couldn't come close to meeting the demand for reservations. Nor were we coming close to meeting the expectations our guests brought with them, especially after the cover story in New York Magazine, which pondered whether Gramercy Tavern might be the next great restaurant. Everyone, it seemed, wanted to judge for himself or herself the answer to the cover. The good news was that we were booked every single night. The painful news is that we were far from being a great restaurant, and plenty of people told us so. Actually, I felt like a miserable failure in 1994-1995. Union Square Cafe appeared to be getting worse. It dropped from number 2 to number 3 on Zagat's list of most popular restaurants. Gramercy Tavern seemed less excellent and less safe than Union Square Cafe, and I was beset with complaint letters and irate phone calls from disappointed guests, many of whom identified themselves as regulars at Union Square Cafe. And I was running around like one of the 3 Stooges with less, not more, time for myself and my family, which by now included a 1-year-old daughter, Hallie. Audrey, who loved Gramercy Tavern almost from the outset, couldn't fully understand why I was pulling my hair out. Of course, she had begun to reprioritize her own talents now that she was a mom, and our beautiful new daughter was far more important than any of my belly aching about either the new or the old restaurant. I knew that Audrey was right, yet I still had the sense of being close to a dangerous outcome. Was I now treading down the same path my father had taken? Expansion to bankruptcy? Had I blown it? I began to look all around me for ways to regain direction and control of both restaurants. Gramercy Tavern was not performing like a champion, and I was becoming painfully aware that my own leadership was to blame. And then personal disaster struck. One Saturday night in the summer of 1995, Audrey suddenly went into premature labor with 22-week-old twins. We grabbed 2-year-old Hallie from her crib, rushed uptown to Lenox Hill Hospital, and after the taxi driver urged us to have a nice day, we tore up to the maternity ward where, despite heroic efforts to halt the labor, Audrey gave birth to 2 tiny babies, a boy and a girl, each weighing no more than a pound. Within 8 hours, both had died. It was a crushing blow that challenged our marriage and our lives if we had not resolved to use every form of therapy available, and in my case, additional intense work with a men's group. The loss almost certainly would have brought us down individually and together. Facing up to the real meanings of life, death, perseverance, survival, and love gave me and Audrey an enhanced sense of urgency and a new perspective on how we spend our time. At this point, I was in a fighting mood, and the object of my focus was Gramercy Tavern. It was time to win at any cost. It was time for me to become even more precise in describing what kind of managers we'd hire, and even more articulate in communicating what was expected of them. At this moment, enlightened hospitality was born. In a meeting of the entire staff of Gramercy Tavern, and with full agreement and support from Tom, I began to outline what I considered non-negotiable about how we did business. Nothing would ever matter more to me than how we expressed hospitality to one another. Whoever wrote the rule that the customer is always first? And then, in descending order, our next core values would be to extend gracious hospitality to our guests, our community, our suppliers, and finally, our investors. I called that set of priorities enlightened hospitality. Every decision we made from that day forward would be evaluated according to enlightened hospitality. We would define our successes as well as our failures in terms of the degree to which we had championed first one another and then our guests, communities, suppliers, and investors. One by one, the staff lined up behind us and grew more confident. Those for whom this way of doing business held no interest left for other restaurants. We were profitable, and at last we were getting good reviews. Ruth Reichel, now restaurant critic for the New York Times, promoted us to a rating of excellent, 3 stars. "It takes a while for a restaurant to hit its stride," she wrote. "There is no timetable for this. Each proceeds at its own pace. It can take a year or two or more before everything comes together in one smooth motion. But when it finally happens, everyone knows it. One step through the door and you can feel the energy running through the room." I conducted the same meeting next at Union Square Cafe, and my first restaurant almost immediately regained its upward course. The staff members rallied to something they could believe in, follow, and support. Perhaps most importantly, I had learned to trust my own instincts and to make them explicit for others. What had once been intuition, ripples I would leave in my wake, could now be transformed into intentional waves. I'd written a new set of rules for my business, and I was at last ready to read them aloud. Now I wanted to turn my attention to Michael Romano. Michael had been somewhat dejected when I corrected all of Union Square Cafe's design flaws by building a new facility at Gramercy Tavern. Though he had invested his own money in Gramercy Tavern, he was envious when he saw that the new restaurant's shining kitchen had everything his didn't have. Even though neither of us was really sure that Michael actually wanted to play a role in launching another restaurant, it was important at least to explore the option. For my part, my own growth as a leader had allowed me to strengthen the foundations of both Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern. It had also helped me become more confident as I contemplated further expansion. I was ready to go for it. By 1995, there were no great or affordable spaces left along Union Square Park, and so I decided to take a look around Madison Square Park, a run-down plot of splotchy green which was a stone's throw away from Union Square and Gramercy Tavern, and which had all the potential upside in the world. I thought we might be able to contribute something new to the traditional bistro or brasserie, so I asked Michael to accompany me on a research trip to Paris, seeking new ideas and inspiration for creating a French version of Union Square Café, Union Square Café itself being an Italian version of Union Square Café. This research proved to be a punishing form of pleasure. On day one, we dined at two different Michelin three-star restaurants, lunch at Robuchon, followed by dinner at Luca Carton. And over the next 48 hours, we ate at six other classic bistros and as many brasseries. Was there anything fresh to express in this niche? I knew that Madison Square Park had once been center stage for New York's social elite at the turn of the 19th century, and it was still one of Manhattan's most significant confluences, 5th and Madison Avenues, Broadway, and 23rd Street. At that time, the park itself was poorly landscaped, dirty, and unsafe, not unlike Union Square Park circa 1985, but without even a spark of retail activity on its perimeter. 23rd Street had a hodgepodge of fast food places, shoeshine shops, and delis, and the three-block stretch of Madison Avenue, as well as 26th Street and 5th Avenue, was practically barren. As I became more enthusiastic about the idea of opening a third restaurant, the possibility of playing a role in reviving Madison Square Park made it even more compelling. This would be a chance to make a bet on an emerging neighborhood while the rents were still affordable, about 50% lower at that time than for comparable spaces around Union Square or in the Flatiron District. Why wouldn't we want to create a wonderful restaurant overlooking what could once again become a beautiful park? I was indeed motivated to open a French-style restaurant with Michael, and a voice within me urged me to become a pioneer in another new community. By coincidence, a real estate consultant contacted us to say that she had been hired to find a nationally known restaurateur for the ground floor space at 11 Madison Avenue, the MetLife building. MetLife was upgrading this historic Art Deco building into Class A office space and had already signed leases with such high-end tenants as Credit Suisse First Boston, CSFB, and some major advertising agencies. We immediately started talking seriously with the agent for the project at 11 Madison. The primary notion of restoring the park was to bring beauty and life to the neighborhood and provide the community with a reason to use the park. That idea reflects one of my core business philosophies. Invest in your community, and the rising tide will lift all boats. A business that understands how powerful it is to create wealth for the community stands a much higher chance of creating wealth for its own investors. I have yet to see a house lose any of its value when a garden is planted in its front yard. And each time one householder plants a garden, chances are the neighbors will follow suit. In mid-1996, I attended my first meeting with executives at MetLife to negotiate a lease. There were all kinds of financial and real estate terms to discuss, but first I made my own agenda, the big picture, clear to our prospective landlord. "Before we discuss any details of a lease," I said at this meeting, "it's important for me to know that you will first commit to partnering with me in rebuilding and restoring Madison Square Park to where it was in its heyday." He may not have fully realized what he was getting his company into, but the MetLife executive, Dom Prezzano, replied, "I don't think you have any idea how many people have tried to do this and for how long, but if you have the energy to lead, we'll lend our financial support." Since the 1970s, it seemed, local business leaders had been disappointed by broken promises from New York City to rebuild the park. Good intentions, it seemed, had always been followed by downturns in the city budget. By the time I started asking questions about reviving the park, most people I spoke to in business or government expressed doubts at best and cynicism at worst. I knew that any restaurant I'd open at 11 Madison could be majestic, but it would come with significant financial and architectural obstacles, and the talks with MetLife went on for nearly a year as we ironed out these issues. Because the building was a designated landmark, we would need to satisfy the requirements of the National Register of Historic Places to preserve and restore existing elements of its historic design, an enormous and costly undertaking. We would need to restore ceiling moldings that were chipped or missing, and repair and restore a 35-foot-long Art Deco fluorescent light fixture, even though we'd never use it. We even had to design lighting fixtures that would surround but not replace the space's original hanging fixtures and sconces to meet historic preservation requirements. All this work would add at least 30% to the normal cost of building a restaurant, and this extra cost would delay any possible return on investment for our shareholders, of whom there would need to be a lot more than the usual few if we were to pull this one off. And there was an even more difficult challenge. A massive wall bisected the first floor of the MetLife building. Since the historic requirements of the building prohibited us from taking it down, we'd have to create two different restaurants, one on either side of the dividing wall. People began telling me that it would be insane to create, design, staff, and open two restaurants simultaneously in the same space. It was becoming abundantly clear to me that I would need to take on more investors and more managing partners, and I did. I did not have the personal funds to build two large restaurants in the space, nor did I have the gumption to go it alone without partners at my side. I began to think intently about where I'd seek financial assistance. I recruited two new colleagues to become my managing partners, David Swinghammer from Chicago's Let Us Entertain You Enterprises, and Richard Corain from San Francisco, who had worked for years with Wolfgang Puck at Post Trio, and who had opened his own restaurant, Hawthorne Lane. When I looked at the two adjoining spaces, it struck me that the larger rectangular room, which had 30-foot-high windows on the park, offered the perfect volume for the heady bustle of a brasserie. There's nothing particularly refined about brasserie standards, oysters, escargot, pig's feet, soup à l'oignon, steak frites, or about the breezy brasserie style of service. It's just meant to be fun. But then I asked myself, whoever wrote the rule that just because you're having all that fun, you can't simultaneously have exquisite food and an extensive list of fine French wines? That was followed by the question, whoever wrote the rule that just because it's a brasserie, you have to serve soup à l'oignon and steak au poivre? How could we combine a brasserie's winsome atmosphere and French culinary accent with an urbane New York point of view to create something unexpected? I wasn't entirely sure of the answer, but whatever it was, that would be restaurant number one. At this point, Michael Romano decided that he did not want to open another restaurant. His true joy was to focus entirely on Union Square Cafe. So together, we hired a chef for our forthcoming restaurant. After some months, it became evident that that relationship would not work out. So then, I consulted with my business partners, and Tom Colicchio pointed me towards Carrie Heffernan. Carrie had been Tom's sous chef years earlier at Mondria and had built a solid resume as an executive chef since then. Tom told me that Carrie was the best cook he had ever worked with. Carrie had just moved to Tavern on the Green from the Westbury Hotel when its restaurant, The Polo, had closed. I liked what I knew of Carrie, and he was ready to join our team. I hired him after just two interviews and without even asking him to prepare a tasting. That left restaurant number two. I still needed to come up with an idea for the smaller space on the other side of the historic wall. One day I was hanging out in Michael's office, and I asked him what he thought we should do there. He shrugged, rubbed his left sideburn, and returned to the cookbook he was intently perusing. "Whatever it is," I said, "I want it to be a leader within its niche." I began flipping through the Zagat survey for 1997, looking in the section on categories. When I got to Indian, I saw that the top-rated Indian restaurant then was a place called Dawat, with a food score of 24 out of a possible 30. That got my attention. "Since you've come to Union Square Cafe," I said, "the restaurant hasn't received less than a 26 for food, and for several years you've earned a 27. Now Michael was listening. He was fascinated by many things Indian. He had studied spices in India, was into yoga, meditation, Indian spirituality. He had even dated Indian women. For several years now, he had been cooking with Indian spices at Union Square Cafe, combining them with French and Italian techniques and ingredients from the green market. By 1996, nearly 25% of the items on the menu at Union Square Cafe were being cooked with some type of Indian spice. Frankly, I told Michael, I just as soon see all those spices used in a new restaurant. They're delicious, but they don't even go with most of the wines in our cellar. Let's build on the success of these Indian dishes you've been cooking at Union Square Cafe and create a whole new restaurant for them. What about doing a new version of an Indian restaurant? He put down the cookbook, looked me in the eye, and smiled broadly. Our new restaurant, Tabla, had been born. Michael and I had been dreaming and talking openly about the Indian venture, and one day Nick Oltarsh, the head tavern cook at Gramercy Tavern, overheard us and made an appointment to come in and see me. "I know the perfect person to be the chef at the restaurant you've been talking about. His name is Floyd Cardoz, and we cook together at L'Espinasse," Nick said. He knew that Michael never intended to abandon Union Square Cafe to become Tabla's day-to-day chef. All I ever hear Floyd talking about was how one day he would show the world that Indians could be great cooks. What you and Michael are talking about happens to be his dream. We learned that Floyd was a native of Bombay and had grown up in Goa, learning all his grandmother's recipes before studying classical French technique in Switzerland. That sounded too good to be true, but it got even better. Floyd Cardoz had been at L'Espinasse, a 4-star restaurant, for over 5 years and was now executive sous chef there, having convinced his chef, Gray Coons, to greatly expand the number of aromatic Indian spices in the restaurant's pantry. We met Floyd, who confirmed that he was eager to break away and do something on his own. His dream was a perfect fit with our vision for Tabla. And after a brilliant tasting in which he cooked 15 dishes for us that made my palate sing and burn with delight, we hired Floyd to be our executive chef. Later, we made him a partner at Tabla. From the moment we had decided on the concept, I sharpened my vision for Tabla. I asked myself, whoever wrote the rule that if you love Indian spices and Indian breads, you should be able to enjoy them only in the context of a purely classical Indian restaurant? I wanted Tabla to become a unique American dining experience, based on Floyd's lifelong passion for the cooking of his homeland. With Floyd's input, I asked our architects, Bentel and Bentel, to design a spice room in the kitchen, a laboratory of sorts where Floyd could bring a piece of fish or meat and experiment with new combinations of tastes. Together, we came up with a harmonious blend of American hospitality, French culinary technique, and expertly applied Indian spices. Soon after Tabla opened, in December 1998, it earned 3 stars from Ruth Reichel of the New York Times. She wrote, "This is American food, viewed through a kaleidoscope of Indian spices. The flavors are so powerful, original, and unexpected that they evoke intense emotions." For the next 2 years after we had opened Tabla and 11 Madison Park, I was not looking for any new restaurant ventures. My plate was full to overflowing. In fact, when my cousin James Polsky asked if I might be interested in collaborating with him at 27 Standard and Jazz Standard, his restaurant and his forward-looking underground jazz club, I had to decline. James was a jazz fanatic with an encyclopedic knowledge of the idiom, and opening the club had been a life's dream for him. The club was receiving accolades and had built a regular clientele, but his upstairs restaurant, despite a strong 2-star review from the New York Times, was experiencing financial losses. James had considered and declined offers from high-profile restaurateurs to buy out the lease on his handsome 2-level loft space on East 27th Street. He was afraid that a new owner would immediately convert the jewel-like jazz club into a private party space. At the same time, I accepted an invitation from Rocco Landisman, a leading Broadway executive, a former St. Louisan, and a friend. He may or may not have known about my lifelong love of barbecue, but he had found an easy mark. "We know this really neat guy from Southern Illinois," Rocco said, "and he's probably the greatest pitmaster I've ever met. His name is Mike Mills. What do you think about coming over for dinner one night to taste some of his ribs?" "You're not talking about doing a barbecue restaurant, are you?" I asked him. "Because I swear I'm not opening another restaurant." My mind shouted at me, "Be careful. Let's try to pick a night when the Cardinals are on TV. We'll grab some beers and get Mike to ship us some of his barbecue," Rocco replied. "I also want you to meet some people who would really love to find a way to bring his barbecue to New York. My good friend Tom Vertel, the theater producer, is in love with Mike. Tom and his partner Pat Daly are judges on the national barbecue circuit. You need to meet these people, even if you can't do it. Maybe you can introduce them to another restaurateur who can." Well, that got my competitive juices flowing. This invitation was tough to turn down, even though I had 4 restaurants and knew that the last thing I needed to do was open a 5th. But these were friends. The idea involved the St. Louis Cardinals. I was a sucker for barbecue, and it struck me as an intriguing idea. I wasn't attending this rib tasting with any expectation that it might lead somewhere. I was just going to discover some excellent barbecue and, I hoped, watch the Cardinals win a ballgame. But the pink-edged, dry-rubbed ribs were remarkable. And so is the moist, smoky pulled pork. The baked beans, made from four kinds of beans, stopped me in my tracks. And this stuff had been frozen, shipped, thawed, and reheated. How good might it be fresh? I suddenly began to ask myself some basic questions such as, why isn't there more good barbecue in a city like New York that has so much of everything and in many cases has the very best? I convinced myself that there were environmental restrictions on producing real pit barbecue, which gives off a lot of smoke. But what if it were possible to overcome that obstacle? I knew that Virgil's Real Barbecue, which was then the most commercially successful barbecue restaurant in New York, had been using some kind of smoke-eating equipment for years, right off Times Square. But I also remembered that the authentic Pearson's in Queens had been forced to relocate its pit to the back of a noisy, crowded sports bar after neighbors complained about smoke at the original site in Long Island City. Still, Manhattan was lacking in authentic barbecue, and Mike Mills was clearly a barbecue artist. After the challenging twin openings of 11 Madison Park and Tabla, perhaps it would be easier this time to do a joint. Slowly but surely, I began to talk myself into the project. I gained confidence by visiting Mike in Murfreesboro, Illinois, and subsequently in Las Vegas, where he had opened two more restaurants. Through long conversations and lots of animated dialogue about business values and barbecue, along with Richard and David, my partners, I took the measure of the man. His gift for the pit was obvious, so was his gift for fascinating gab, and a bond of trust was growing between us. One day it occurred to me that this was precisely the right fit for my cousin's restaurant space at 27 Standard, and that Jazz Standard would be a natural home for good barbecue. Beginning in urban Kansas City, barbecue and jazz had long been bedfellows. Why not here in New York? One by one, my partners gave me thumbs up, and with their unanimous support, we made a deal for the space with my cousin James. He would stay on as an owner to help ensure the outstanding music for Jazz Standard, and we would create Blue Smoke and be responsible for the restaurant and club operations. We invited Mike Mills, nationally famous for his prize-winning barbecue recipes, to become our chief Q consultant. I called him our rib rabbi. We paid him in equity and asked him to teach us and our chef everything he had learned, not only on the competitive circuit, but also in his own restaurants. We selected Kenny Callahan, who had been a dedicated cook and sous chef at Union Square Cafe for over 8 years, to be the pitmaster and executive chef of Blue Smoke. Kenny's culinary background had little to do with barbecue. Before cooking at Union Square Cafe, he had worked at the Russian Tea Room. But his disciplined approach to cooking made him the perfect choice for Blue Smoke. The most successful barbecue pitmasters have a passion for doing the same thing over and over, each day finding nuanced ways to improve on what they did yesterday. Barbecue's not a matter of creativity so much as a matter of dogged perseverance and execution. Kenny's no-nonsense personality, straightforward cooking style, and persistent pursuit of ways to do things better made him an ideal choice. We also chose another veteran of Union Square Cafe, Mark Maynard Parisi, to become Blue Smoke's opening general manager. It had always been a priority of mine to develop leaders from within, both for the sake of team morale and as an assurance that we would begin our new restaurant with as much of our pre-existing DNA as possible. Letting our business grow on the shoulders of those who've gotten us there provides safety and is its own rationale for growing in the first place. Mike Mills gave Kenny Callahan and Micah Romano, who was emerging as our chief culinary sage, an intensive hands-on course in real pit barbecue technique, teaching them in his restaurant pits and giving them a competitive role in the famous Apple City Barbecue Contest in Murfreesboro, Illinois. Perhaps because it was just a joint, Blue Smoke was in some ways the most challenging restaurant to design. Many beloved barbecue joints around the country are on the wrong side of the tracks, and part of what people love about going to them is having to travel to a rural outpost or a down-and-out part of town to hunt down the ethereal smoked pork. The barbecue seems to taste better both because of what you have to do and because of where you have to go to get it. That's also why hot dogs taste better at the ballpark and why Vernaccia di San Gimignano tastes better in Tuscany. Context is everything. Manhattan's Park Avenue in the East 20s is not many people's idea of the wrong side of the tracks. Once again, we turn to the architects Bentel and Bentel to help us arrive at an authentic solution. The questions about design were basic but crucial. For instance, how could we blend traditional barbecue elements with what is real for a Manhattan restaurant? It was a foregone conclusion that we wouldn't resort to such cliches as bowling trophies, photographs of softball teams, or caricatures of smiling piggies. Yet, such cliches are tempting because they help guests to understand exactly what a restaurant is out to accomplish. People do want to feel transported when they go to a restaurant. First, we knew we'd need booths, a common feature of barbecue restaurants. A booth can take the form of a picnic table, as is common in the Texas Hill Country, or it can have a formica tabletop with hard, uncomfortable benches on either side, as in the barbecue joints of North Carolina. But we needed to have barbecue booths that made sense in New York. So we chose comfortable leather cushions as upholstery, and we came up with a tabletop made of a finer laminate than cold, hard formica. We also made sure to have the classic black menu board with red and white plastic lettering hanging above our bar. But we did not attempt authenticity by deliberately using an old Coca-Cola sponsorship sign or misspelling pork sandwiches and rib tips on the menu. There could not be even a hint of a theme park. We included a genuine New York element, an exciting, comprehensive listing of microbrew beers, bourbons, classic cocktails, and world-class wines by the glass, not your typical accompaniment to barbecue. Thoughtful design and loving cooking would go a long way toward giving the restaurant's soul and authenticity. It would need to exist in harmony with its own building, its neighborhood, and the city. Once you step inside a theme park, you could be anywhere. We were determined that Blue Smoke would be an actual place, which is exactly what it turned out to be. And it was a place that ultimately distinguished itself in every way. My youth in St. Louis also inspired my restaurant Shake Shack, the burger, hot dog, and frozen custard stand we created in 2004 for Madison Square Park. Anyone who grew up in the automobile culture in the 1950s or 1960s probably had the experience of hanging out at a local stand or shack serving this type of food. Growing up in St. Louis, I spent a lot of time hanging out with my family and friends at places like Schneidhorst, the Parkmore, Ted Drew's Frozen Custard, Fitz's Root Beer Stand, and Steak and Shake. I especially love them for their curbside service. In fact, I can't remember many weekend nights during my teenage years that didn't culminate at one of those places. And when I had lived in Chicago for 2 summers during and after graduating from college, I couldn't resist a more than occasional Chicago hot dog topped with its 9 traditional accessories served on a poppy seed bun. I had come to miss the drive-ins, car hops, and burger and shake stands of my youth, and today's version of fast food, both the sanitized experience and the production line food, was an unacceptable substitute. As always with our new ventures, the idea was to draw on the best elements of the classic, make it authentic for its present context, and then try to execute it with excellence. There's nothing particularly innovative about any single component of Shake Shack. The key, as always, would be how we might blend all the components to make it feel original. The inception of Shake Shack actually began with a humble hot dog cart. In the summer of 2001, our fledgling organization, the Campaign for a New Madison Square Park, persuaded Target stores to sponsor a series of group art shows for the park, curated by the Public Art Fund and in collaboration with the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs. A Thai sculptor, Navin Rawenshikal, created a colorful work for the show called I Love Taxi, which featured cartoon-like sculptures of taxicabs on stilts. The artist also designed a working hot dog cart to go with the project, since he believed that the world's 2 most democratic institutions were taxicabs and hot dogs. In his view, every human being on Earth has either driven or ridden in a taxi and has either served or been served a hot dog. I Love Taxi was installed at the southern end of the park, not far from 11 Madison Park. And when asked, We volunteered to give life to the project by actually operating the sculpture's hot dog cart. We began by asking ourselves whether there was anything fresh we might bring to the world of hot dog carts. Small as the project was, or seemed, I took this cart quite seriously. I was eager to use the project as a test of enlightened hospitality. I was asking myself, whoever wrote the rule that you can't push the envelopes of excellence and hospitality for something as ordinary as a hot dog cart? Could a hot dog cart ever be anything more than just a hot dog cart? My team and I decided to feature Chicago-style hot dogs from a Chicago vendor, Vienna Beef, and boil them in water spiked with garlic, coriander, and bay leaves. We would serve the hot dogs on poppy seed buns, shipped especially from Chicago, with the requisite toppings: celery salt, onions, green peppers, tomatoes, mustard, pickles, spicy sport peppers, cucumbers, and neon relish. Our menu was limited, but we would also serve bags of homemade beet-stained potato chips, fresh verbena lemonade, salty chocolate truffle cookies, and iced tea. We staffed the cart with members of 11 Madison Park's winter coat check crew, providing them with summer employment. And Carrie Heffernan was our supervising chef. I assigned the project of running the cart to one of 11 Madison Park's managers as a low-risk way to learn how to run a small business. To go with her addictive chocolate cookies, the pastry chef Nicole Kaplan also contributed refined Rice Krispie treats. It turned out that there was some risk. By the time I Love Taxi and its hot dog cart stand closed in early September 2001, we had actually lost nearly $5,000 operating the cart. While demand had been high and lines were always long, we had addressed my requirement for excellence in hospitality by hiring too many people, working in a very inefficient system. But there was a clamor from the neighborhood for us to return with the cart in 2002, even though that summer brought new sculpture to the park that had nothing to do with loving taxis or hot dogs. And so we did. During the second summer, we got a little smarter about our operations and production systems, and we nearly broke even. But it was 2003 that proved to be the tipping point for the profitability of the hot dog cart. Every day, beginning at 11:30 in the morning, as many as 70 people would line up for a Chicago dog. We could barely keep up. We needed three tables behind the cart just so the staff could assemble the hot dogs and all the assorted toppings. Throughout the day, reinforcements were wheeled through the park from our kitchen at 11 Madison Park, and some days we ran out of hot dogs well before closing hour. Before long, Newsweek, Newsday, Crain's New York Business, CNN, and each of the big three national nightly news shows, NBC, CBS, and ABC, had done stories on our little cart. Writing for the New York Times, Alex Witchell helped create longer lines than ever when she called our cart the hot dog connoisseur's equivalent of fine dining. The restaurant critics William Grimes and Eric Asimov of the New York Times both wrote reviews and each had favorable things to say about the product. We wanted our hospitality to be at the highest possible level. Without reservation lists, our staff never knew any of the guests' names, so the emphasis was on recognizing repeat customers by face and remembering their usual orders. And with nine toppings, everyone seemed to have a personal preference. We believe that a customer's desire to be recognized could just as easily be satisfied by a summer intern at our hot dog cart as by the host in the dining room of a three-star restaurant. We encouraged our young, energetic staff to create plus ones, or legends of hospitality, offering those in line free samples and cookies and spotting, say, a regular man on a park bench, making him his usual order and bringing it over to him just as he started to head for the line. Though they were spending $2.50 for a hot dog, the loyalty of these guests was no less important to us than that of our regulars at Gramercy Tavern or Tabla. Our application of enlightened hospitality had proved a phenomenal success. Our staff loved the work, our patrons were captivated, the park was bustling, Vienna Beef was thrilled with the unexpected business in New York, and by the season's end, we presented a check for $7,500 to the newly formed Madison Square Park Conservancy. Around that time, the city's Department of Parks and Recreation had solicited proposals to create and operate a permanent kiosk in Madison Square Park. We were game, and we decided to expand on the hot dog cart and make our dream of a drive-in come alive for good, and for the good of the park. We submitted our proposal as operators in collaboration with the Madison Square Park Conservancy, with the understanding that the kiosk itself would be built with funds raised through a philanthropic campaign, allowing us to own the business and the conservancy and the city to be our landlords, and that we would pay rent as a percentage of our sales to both the Madison Square Park Conservancy and the New York Department of Parks and Recreation. As we imagined our new kiosk, we thought about a lot more than food. We understood that people don't go out just to eat. They also select restaurants in order to be part of a community experience. Starbucks took the notion of drinking good coffee and standing in line to buy it and figured out how to make the experience of drinking coffee with a community of other like-minded people become the real star of the show. The company also learned to superimpose its blueprint onto thousands of locations, north, south, east, and west, while also conveying the sense that each Starbucks belonged to its particular community. It was brilliant entrepreneurship to grasp that selling excellent coffee is actually secondary to creating a sense of community. Coffee sells and is habit-forming, but performing a daily ritual with a self-selected group of like-minded human beings also sells. A business that doesn't understand its raison d'etre as fostering community will inevitably underperform. My thinking about what we might add to the mission of the Madison Square Park Conservancy had been shaped largely by my experience as an active member of the board of the Union Square Partnership, responsible for the safety, development, programming, and overall welfare of Union Square. I understood that it's not enough to just restore a park. You must also sustain its beauty and safety by providing good citizens with lots of reasons to visit it. Otherwise, you've merely given the park a temporary facelift. Union Square Park had always relied on the green market as its most powerful magnet in attracting people. Other attractions were the park's playgrounds, its dog run, and Luna Park, its summertime restaurant. We won the city's competitive bidding process because of the strength of our overall proposal for Shake Shack, including our culinary idea, because the city had confidence in us as operators, and certainly because of the design and financing plan for the kiosk itself. It was challenging to create a model whereby the city would share the percentage rent revenue stream with the conservancy, but we made a strong case for that, and eventually the idea was embraced. Using the kitchen of 11 Madison Park's private dining room as our laboratory for Shake Shack, we worked hard to come up with just the right mixture of freshly ground beef, tasting many variations until at last we landed upon what we thought was the perfect ratio of ground sirloin steak to brisket. The fat-to-meat blend yielded a juicy, intensely beefy result. We debated what the precise size of the burger should be, to the half ounce. We argued over the choice of buns, soft potato, tomatoes, plum, lettuce, bib, and sauce, our secret. We chose every one of our ingredients with extreme care and with an eye toward authenticity. For the Chicago dogs, we decided on Plockman's mustard over French's. We opted not to serve Dijon mustard, taking the position that no gourmet condiments belonged at Shake Shack. We chose crinkle-cut fries, just like the ones I had grown up loving at Fitz's Root Beer Stand in St. Louis, because they deliver more crunch per bite than shoestring fries, and because they make good cheese fries. In a blind tasting, we selected Abita, a richly flavored root beer from Louisiana. Frozen custard, as I wrote on our opening menu, is what happens when premium ice cream shacks up with soft-serve ice cream, but with a stickier texture and an eggier taste. We worked with Nicole Kaplan, our talented pastry chef at 11 Madison Park, to zero in on our own recipe, tasting several top custards from around the country, shipped overnight by FedEx as the benchmarks. Shake Shack became not just a huge success, but also a wonderful business model. Because a percentage of every sale becomes rent, paid both to the conservancy and to the city, every hot dog, burger, frozen custard, or beverage purchased and enjoyed by a guest contributes something to the park's ongoing vitality. Shake Shack is a useful example of a for-profit entity whose success contributes monetarily and programmatically to the community. It shows that you can do well by doing good. Perhaps most important, it serves as a human magnet, attracting all kinds of people of all ages and from all walks of life to the park. That makes them stakeholders in the park, and it increases the odds that the park will remain beautiful, safe, and enjoyed. I never assumed that the Shack's success was going to be defined by someone saying, "This is the best hamburger I've ever had." One thing we had learned from Blue Smoke is that it's just about impossible to create the best version of anything when the context is comfort food. It's pretty tough to compete with the warmth of deeply emotional food memories. But I would love it if we were fortunate enough to stay in this business long enough and continued to execute consistently well so that today's young people might one day be in a burger joint somewhere with their kids and say, "The best hamburger I ever had when I was growing up was at Shake Shack." It always feels wonderful to earn a rave from guests, and not just for the way we've nourished them. Over the years, the most consistent compliment we've received, and the one I'm always proudest to hear, is, "I love your restaurants and the food is fantastic, but what I really love is how great your people are." The only way a company can grow, stay true to its soul, and remain consistently successful is to attract, hire, and keep great people. It's that simple, and it's that hard. In many industries, and undeniably in ours, the competition to hire the most talented people is stiff. The stakes couldn't be higher. The human beings who animate our restaurants have far more impact on whether we succeed than any of the food ingredients we use, the decor of our dining rooms, the bottles of wine in our cellars, or even the location of our restaurants. Because hospitality is a dialogue, I have always placed the highest premium on hiring the best possible staff to engage our guests. In 2004, as we prepared to open one restaurant, two cafes, and a staff cafeteria at the Museum of Modern Art, and enter the off-premise catering business as well, we knew that the size of our organization was about to double to over 1,000 staff members, and it was critical to develop an even larger team of extraordinary leaders. We searched high and low for the rare employees who love teaching, know how to set the table, work with a sense of urgency, and most important, are comfortable with holding people accountable to high standards while letting them hold on to their own dignity. Time after time, I had noticed that great leaders tend to have a heightened sense of how to attract and hire other extraordinary people so that we can achieve our business goals of extending warm hospitality while performing at a high level of excellence. We look intently for strong emotional and technical skills when hiring staff people. Theoretically, if the ideal candidate were to score 100 on a suitability test, which is something we've never administered, his or her potential for technical excellence would count for 49%, while innate emotional skills for hospitality would count for 51%. I first learned this concept of 51% from the dynamic restaurateur Rich Melman of Chicago when I visited him in the late 1980s. Rich was an effervescent teacher and a willing mentor, and I was eager and honored to learn from him. The concept made perfect sense to me, and now it is a cornerstone of our business. Our staff performance reviews weigh both technical job performance at 49% and emotional job performance at 51%, which is how staff members perform their duties and how they relate to others on a personal level. In some respects, this is another intentional business strategy based on instincts I developed while I was growing up. Among my friends were plenty of good athletes and talented students, but far more important to me than a friend's skills was always his or her goodness as a person. Imagine if every business were a light bulb, and that for each light bulb, the primary goal was to attract the most moths possible. Now, what if you learned that 49% of the reason moths were attracted to a bulb was for the quality of its light, brightness being the task of the bulb, and that 51% of the attraction was to the warmth projected by the bulb, heat being connected with the feeling of the bulb? It's remarkable to me how many businesses shine brightly when it comes to acing the tasks, but emanate all the warmth of a cool fluorescent light. That explains how a flawless 4-star restaurant can actually attract far fewer loyal fans than a 2- or 3-star place with soul. In business, I want to be overcome with moths. Our staff must be like a scintillating string of 100-watt light bulbs whose product is the sum of 51% feeling and 49% task. It is my firm conviction that an executive or business owner should pack a team with 51%ers, because training them in the technical aspects will then come far more easily. Hiring 51%ers today will save training time and dollars tomorrow. And they are commonly the best recruiters for others with strong emotional skills. Nice people love the idea of working with other nice people. Over time, we can almost always train for technical prowess. We can teach people how to deliver bread or olives, take orders for drinks or present menus, how to describe specials, make recommendations from the wine list, or how to explain the cheese selection. And it's straightforward to teach table numbers and seat positions so that we avoid asking who gets the chicken. That question always sounds amateurish and makes a guest feel as if the waiter didn't pay attention in the first place. A cook needs to know from his chef precisely what the sautéed sea bass is supposed to look like when it's sautéed properly, how it tastes when it's seasoned.